PhD in aesthetics, and I'm a researcher of aesthetics at the University of Helsinki. So I'm going to speak about the theme of colonialism from a very different angle from the previous speakers. So my title is Whose Aesthetics, Colonization and Decolonization in Art Philosophy, and of course colonization here is a more or less metaphorical term. So in this paper I examine something of the dynamics that can be discerned in the history of aesthetic theories. I shall pay attention especially to the need to overcome the previous theories and theoreticians to decolonize their allegedly colonizing influence that, at a given moment, may appear as totalizing and encompassing. I shall argue that the urge to move from one position to another is and has often been motivated and has also often been motivated by a kind of strife, or a kind of strife is behind them, a change of paradigm that includes a severe dispute, a situation that, for instance, Jean-François Lyotard has nominated as the différent, or different. But what happens in this situation? If a will of decolonization follows a situation when a number of theoreticians feel being colonized by stifling theoretical positions that have already begun to seem outmoded in their attitudes? Or is it rather that colonization and decolonization are not simply subsequent events, nor do they follow a logical order, but they are often overlapping and related to each other in changing ways? In some current of thought, if some current of thought becomes dominant, what is the next phase? Is it even greater popularity and dominance, or is the consequence of success rather a will to suppress new and otherwise competing modes of thinking? This leaves also the questions about the grounds on which the situations develop, as well as what progress is. So I first go to aesthetics as a discipline and its fundamental ambiguities. As a discipline, aesthetics seems to be liable to changes as how to its field is defined. In this respect, it is quite similar to the concept of philosophy, of which it of course forms a part. In this sense, aesthetics doesn't differ from many other fields of philosophy. Aesthetics has been the target of many disputes. Its concept and scope are ambiguous in themselves. As it's stated, for example, in the book A Dictionary of Untranslatables, edited by French Barbara Cassin, the main reason is that problems concern the epistemological coherence of the term aesthetics. Namely, in its modern sense, aesthetics refers to not a unified field of problems, but to a double meaning. It includes both the fields of knowledge, both the field of knowledge bearing on art and the beautiful, and at the same time, the study of the sensible, its special knowledge, methods, and objects. The two phases of the domain of aesthetics has its roots in Plato and Aristotle, although neither of them used the term aesthetics to describe this discipline. However, both Plato and Aristotle made the distinction between aistheta and noeta. The first, aistheta, designated sensible things or facts associated with perception, while noeta stood for intelligible things, that is to say, knowledge. Later, or much later, in the 18th century, this distinction was still reflected in the theories of the German philosopher A.G. Baumgarten, who is considered to have used the term aesthetics for the first time in the meaning that we know it today, and thereby he is often credited for founding the discipline of aesthetics in its modern form. Around the year 1735, Baumgarten determined aesthetics as the science of the mode of sensory knowledge and exposition. Thus, in coining this definition, he tried to keep sensory perception and intellection distinct. But soon afterwards, he saw it necessary to renounce this definition, and he extended it so that it covered both the sensory field and that of its thinking. For Baumgarten, aesthetics was then the science of the sensible knowledge in 1750. As a result, the term aesthetics brought together the fields of the logical and the sensible. This determination has a fundamental importance for the future conception of aesthetics. Philosophers of art have either wanted to justify, in one way or another, the unity of the incompatible elements of aesthetic judgment, knowledge, and senses, or to renounce it and rather put the emphasis on either the intellectual or the sensory as the fundamental core of the discipline of aesthetics. This duality has resulted in many contradictions and inconsistencies within the discipline, and they are still evident in theories and assumptions concerning the nature of the research of the aesthetic. Aesthetics today means research of both aesthetic experience and aesthetic values, such as beauty, the study of artistic taste and of art, and other aesthetic objects alike. Yet it also means the research of perceptual experience. Depending on these tendencies, what is considered as aesthetics is either empirical or speculative, descriptive or normative in nature. In his philosophy of the aesthetic judgment, Immanuel Kant offers the best known and most far-reaching example of bringing together the two sides of the experience, so knowledge and the sensible. The aim is to reconcile their incoherence. In Kant's treatise of the transcendental aesthetic, included in the Critique of Judgment from 1790, Kant points out that the German use of aesthetics refers to the philosophy of the beautiful, whereas for others it designates the critique of taste. Kant wants to show that Baumgarten is not able to create a priori rules of the aesthetic to the aesthetic judgment, as he perceives that the criteria suggested by Baumgarten are too empirical. As a result, Kant says, Baumgarten's rules cannot be elevated to a science. Therefore, Kant's main question concerns the possibility of speaking philosophically about the judgment of taste or of beauty. How to reconcile the conceptual and the a priori forms of perception and the non-conceptual, the critique of taste and feelings. These are the two sides of the experience of beauty that are both involved in it. If logical judgments depend on the correlation between the concept and the phenomenon, aesthetic judgments are subjective and thus applied to the object of beauty without any determining rule. Kant's theory gathers together the without concept and concept, universality without concept and universality with concept. His goal is thus to bring the critical estimation of the beautiful under principles of reason. From the 19th century onwards, and the term aesthetic seems necessary on the epistemological and scientific level, but at the same time, it's difficult to give it any consistent definition. Depending on the aims, aesthetics may from there on refer to philosophy of art, philosophy of the beautiful, theory of taste, theory of art, theory of fine arts, theory, science, or critique of the beautiful, as well as variations of these definitions. It has been suggested that in the 20th century, aesthetics loses its relational and interdisciplinary character and comes on to mean rather a kind of generalist and referential meta-theory or meta-discourse, theory of the ways in which art and the aesthetic appear in philosophical discussion. Yet the distinction between the incoherent elements, the sensible and the intellectual, continues to divide theories in a crucial way. In the 20th century, it even determines whether aesthetics should be speculative or empirical in character, or whether aesthetic judgments are rather normative or descriptive. Such divisions are behind the orientations that are called, in a rough way, continental and analytic aesthetics. It is another question whether there is any consensus of this division. In the analytic tradition, the empirical use of aesthetic concepts marks a central point of departure, whereas the so-called continental tradition rather relies on the speculative philosophy of art. With analytic thinkers, the Kantian divergence between aesthetics and philosophy is more visible, whereas the difference between their methods and goals is less clear-cut. In the scheme of aesthetics as a discipline, there have been, and still are, a number of diverse and competing tendencies that are motivated differently. Arguing about what counts as aesthetics, what its main objectives are, and how to approach the chosen research questions is almost inevitably a matter of power. why the need for paradigm changes arises. Who is justified to argue for the directions that are taken at a given time? Or can we say that it's only a question of the validity of arguments? More generally, what kinds of views are accepted by the community and on which grounds? To answer these questions, I see the concepts of colonization and eventual decolonization to be of some help. And then I move to aesthetics as politics, followed by a question mark. It soon becomes visible that choices made in deciding which approaches to take may not be completely neutral. Not only matters of pure argument and argumentative logic, nor theoretical conclusions required by the research question, but behind these approaches may lie different motivations. To examine the aims that are often hidden, various strategies of counter-aesthetics have been created. Among these are theories that focus on the political, feminist, and colonial implications of the aesthetic discourse. Conversely, similar development has happened in the varieties of activist art that looks at how art may alter the political by altering aesthetic perceptions of the sensible. Varieties of counter-aesthetics have been developed to show the limits of dominant aesthetics. The main idea here is the thought that aesthetic, or in considering aesthetics as politics, is the thought that aesthetics equals politics. It originated especially in Germany from the 1930s to the 50s. In their writings, philosophers such as Georg Lukács, Ernst Bloch, Walter Benjamin, and Theodor Adorno, as well as Bertolt Brecht, interpreted and utilized classics of aesthetic theories, Marxist philosophy, and reacted polemically to the challenges of capitalism in the modern world. Yet there was also a constant dispute between these thinkers. The writings of the philosophers above were often directed towards the German petty bourgeoisie that had been captivated by fascism. Background to this was that the quotidian and cultural life was the quotidian and cultural life. To win the petty bourgeois masses over to the working class was considered necessary for the revolution that Germany seemed to need in the 1930s. For Georg Lukács, for example, the Germany of late 19th and early 20th centuries had been dominated by philosophies, neo-Kantianism and vitalism, that abolished the connections between ideology and economics and politics. For this reason, it prevented any perception of or critique of imperialist and capitalist society as a whole. The philosophers who understood aesthetics to be inseparable from politics honored in the work of the classical heritage of the Enlightenment. They also assimilated modernist trends of literature to irrationalism and criticized fascism in politics and culture. Many of their fundamental themes and concerns were transmitted by the Frankfurt School. Similar influences became visible in the anti-war movements of the 1960s and, for instance, in the activities of the Telgel group in France in the 60s and after that. The ideas of the political implications of aesthetics has resulted in various shifts of paradigm in aesthetic theories. To put it in broadest possible terms, no longer is aesthetics colonized by a disinterested spectator in the Kantian manner, but an act of decolonization has supposedly happened when thinkers have rather perceived that aesthetics equals politics. According to Jacques Rancière, who has become in Finland especially well known through translations of Tutkijaliitto, each community holds certain aesthetic coordinates. They form the distribution of the sensible, a system of divisions and boundaries that define what is visible and audible within a particular aesthetico-political regime. From these divisions follows that some groups and social positions are excluded from the hierarchies of the sensible. As Rancière argues, such hierarchies have existed since Plato's times. They are maintained by what he calls the police. It is a system of coordinates that establishes and regulates the distribution of the sensible, an implicit law that divides the community into groups, social roles, and functions. The law separates a priori those who are included from those who cannot participate in the systems of the aesthetic realm. It regulates what is visible and what is invisible, audible and inaudible, and sayable and unsayable in a community. The essence of politics that is in many respects contrary to the functioning of the police is to interrupt the distribution of the sensible and to supplement it with those who have no part in the perceptual coordinates of the community. Thereby, the aesthetico-political field of possibility will perhaps be modified. This will happen by putting into practice the presupposition of politics, namely democracy, that all are equal. To attain democracy in the field of aesthetics simultaneously requires emancipation in society, that is, decolonization of the sensible, detachment from the earlier social assumptions, both visible and invisible. Another politically oriented strategy of decolonization is feminist aesthetics. Its theoreticians consider aesthetics to imply questions related to the gender of the philosophers, aesthetic values and value judgments, artists, and the whole art world. Feminist aesthetics moves around issues on the boundary between artistic research, aesthetics, and feminist theory. Its objects include gender and power, their hierarchies, and the challenging of patriarchal conventions, identity, and definitions of gender. Feminist aesthetics explores a gender system that is assumed to produce stereotypes, inequalities, and discrimination, whether in language, concepts, images, thinking, or action. Writers like Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick, Rita Felsky, or bell hooks seeking counter-aesthetics from feminist thinking have been openly political in their assessment of women's position in relation to what they consider the prevailing aesthetic discourse. Analysis of gender-based power relationships are driving forces in this endeavor that in the recent years has often derived from Judith Butler's theories of gender as performative and a historical and ideological construction. The aim of feminist aestheticians is to read in new ways the basic philosophical assumptions of aesthetics, a hitherto male-dominated discipline. These include the aesthetics of autonomy inherited from the Enlightenment and, of course, especially Kant's philosophy. The aesthetics of autonomy refers to the views expressed in Kant's Critique of Judgment regarding subject and knowledge as generally valid, timeless, and placeless concepts. That Kant perceives the aesthetic experience as disinterested means that for him such experience is not dependent on any practical interests. Instead of being interested in the Kantian form of experience or the form of the art object, like most modernist and formalist aestheticians, comes the content of art and its political implication with feminist aesthetics. These preconditions are what some feminist theorists have described as pure aesthetics. Their aim is to reveal the underlying principles of aesthetic autonomy, that the supposedly universal subject is a well-to-do or white heterosexual man, qualities that characterize also the concept of genius. It is revealed that the subject of Enlightenment philosophy, and thereby of modernity, is determined by gender, race, social, and historical status. Another question is whether another typical group of academics, a white middle-class woman, inevitably ends up representing pure aesthetics once more, or after all, differs from its ideals. This questioning is often not apparent with earlier theorists, although it has been examined by recent intersectional feminist thinkers. A counterattack to these allegedly objective standpoints is provided by not pure but impure aesthetics that differs from the concepts of autonomous forces of colonizing thought. Impurity means in this context the emergence of a politicized, ideological, gendered, racialist, sexually oriented and class-bound subject. The ideals of timeless and placeless modernism have had to give way to more everyday expressions and aesthetics of the grotesque, unholy, and banal, instead of beauty and harmony. And instead of beauty and harmony arrive ugly, fragmentary, and chaotic works by which avant-garde artists seek to disturb modernists. The reaction to the subject of aesthetic theories that were believed to follow from it have led avant-garde theorists to politicize art and its experience. This has required the directing of attention to the production and reception of art and the networks of knowledge and power that govern them, rather than to the seemingly unpolitical research of artworks. However, the paradox of the feminist theories is, or maybe that as discourses of resistance, they wouldn't have been possible without the supposed patriarchal ideology of previous theoretical orientations. On the other hand, this dialectical paradox applies to practically all kinds of counterpositions, in aesthetics or otherwise. So above, I have taken up only two examples of the history of aesthetics that where there seems to exist a conflict between theories colonized by certain manners of thought and attempts at decolonizing them by bringing new alternatives in the place of the old attitudes. This development is linked with recognizing and making visible different power relations, and I see it to be associated with the two paradigms, sensing and knowing, in the development of aesthetics as a discipline. So, these two sides of aesthetics are also reflected in the viewpoints of politics and gender, but parallels may be found elsewhere as well, in visual art, for example. Last week, the Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson won the Ars Fennica Prize in Helsinki with his video The Boat. It's still on display at the Amos Rex Museum. It belongs to his series Scenes from Western Culture. The length of the boat is 2.5 hours, and I now show just 34 seconds, which is the length of this sample. The whole work is in the museum. The length of the boat is 2.5 hours in total. In the film, the same event keeps repeating with minor variations. A motorboat brings a romantic couple to the lakeshore. They exit the boat, say goodbye to each other, and the lady walks away. The boat can be watched, of course, in various ways. It may present to the viewer an innocent scene of ideal beauty of a landscape in Switzerland and a well-off, white, youngish male-female couple. From another angle, the scene might be a sign in itself and entirely coded. It doesn't show us merely an idyllic lakeside, but a blatant Western capitalist dream, shot in the most expensive country in the world, and with them a jungle of clichés of what we often consider to be an idea of success. The repetition of this ideological scene has no end in the loop-like film. Conflicts within aesthetics suggest that perceptions and concepts are not related in a way that would be merely neutral, but perceptual and theoretical concepts are interrelated. According to a general notion of modern philosophy of science, the theoretical concepts and preconceptions concerning the object of inquiry influence the way in which the object, such as the objects of aesthetic theories, is observed, how the observations are interpreted, and what claims they seem to be evidence of. In aesthetic theories, like in other sciences, research is often guided by paradigms of research that display, for example, dynamics theorized in Thomas Kuhn's theories on scientific revolutions. However, for example, the field of aesthetics, there usually exist many possible theories and orientations simultaneously. According to Kuhn, within a paradigm, knowledge accumulates and theories are redefined. In the scientific revolution, the paradigm shifts so that knowledge and theories do not change quantitatively but qualitatively. As it seems, the so-called shift or the need to new kind of theoretical alternatives takes place when there is an irreconcilable contradiction, when something is considered incorrect enough and a change seems necessary. In this, one may arrive at the situation that Jean-François Lyotard has termed as dispute or different. For Lyotard, these are primarily of discursive nature. They mean radical lack of understanding, conflicts that cannot be solved by juridical means, states without a common measure, a state in which narratives, like the one defining aesthetic experience or its subject, are confronted. The disputes of, Razier has called them disagreements, are conflicts between the distributions of the senses and the outside. It is a function of art and politics to provoke or prove controversy. Art, politics, and perhaps their theories exacerbate disputes to resist injustice that silences those who do not speak the language of the dominant culture. Disputes and disagreements between theoretical stances lead to acknowledging their fundamental differences. However, as I see it, the differences are nothing but stable. As differences, their power is in that they try to avoid the return to the language of the same, the discourse of the former establishment. This is what puts the relation between the colonization and decolonization in motion and motivates the change. Yet, one may inquire whether any change in these relations shall last forever, or in fact, what the extent of the change really is. Can a paradigm shift ever be a total one, so that the instances of the old power will be entirely forgotten in the future? Is the regime change ever complete, or does it rather lead to a coexistence of possible paradigms? This means asking whether different theories are, in fact, interchangeable. There are concurrent views based on different presuppositions, and from this follows that colonization and the process of its demolition are almost never total, concerning all possible points of departure and presumptions, but rather more subtle and intricate. Instead of revolution as a complete shift in positions, there is dissemination, rather. Differences and relations between things multiply. Points of convergence and contention continue to appear as theoretical standpoints, and they evolve further. Different social situations necessitate change, but this necessity can also be mostly rhetorical when it is the discourse that produces antagonism by creating certain setups. And what happens after the revolution when the decolonizer gains power and recognized status? Shall a new paradigm emerge? Here the crucial question is how to maintain a critical and especially self-critical position and attitude. Is this possible, or shall one fall into the revolutionary paradox when the alternative becomes the establishment? So I'm coming to the end now. Disputes and disagreements between theoretical stances are no. Sorry. A theoretical orientation, be it in the field of aesthetics or otherwise, that at one moment seems novel and radical, may become after a while decolonized in turn. This idea, as I would like to argue, makes the intangible, non-conceptual structural difference or tension between theories the potential of agency and the center of interest. What makes them conflicting? The emergence of fractures seem to differentiate it. Something that is not yet given, not yet fully articulated and only becoming, and thus still free to change the positions out of the reach of any colonization. This difference, namely in its formlessness and lack of pre-established knowledge of its own possibilities, can create the space of open potential for variation and change for future thinking. Thank you.